This is Dr. Ong, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. We have a brief announcement to make. Plume Health is pleased to sponsor this episode of the Umbrella Hour podcast. Plume Health is the largest virtual provider of healthcare, including gender-affirming care and transition support services for trans and gender-diverse adults in the United States. To learn more about Plume Health, their full range of services, insurance plans they accept, and states they operate in, visit getplume.co. That's getplume, P-L-U-M-E, dot C-O. Now I'm going to turn this over to you, Xander.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ann. I'm really happy to introduce you to our guest today. Dr. Kirkley is here to discuss how Plume Health has transformed the care landscape for the trans community in the United States, despite the adversarial political climate. That's stating it a little lightly, I think. But welcome to the show, Dr. Kirkley.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. For the duration of the interview, would it be okay if we went more casual and used first names?
Yeah, that's totally fine.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'd love to hear a little bit more about Plume. Specifically, how did it begin? What was the impetus for getting Plume started?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it really starts with my experience as an individual, but also my co-founder. And I mean, to go way back, I even thought about going into medicine in the first place because I saw it as this vehicle for social justice. That's what drew me in. And I had seen and studied a lot of the movements that have come before. I think thinking about things like the civil rights movement, the founding of community health centers that was born out of that, seeing things like the AIDS epidemic, and the formation of health centers that came out of that as well. And this idea of caring for vulnerable, marginalized communities that otherwise were not getting the care that they needed in our system. And I had seen that certainly in the US. I had traveled a lot in college and seen that abroad in other countries that were struggling with that same issue. And so that was really the driver for me. And all that was important because when I got into medical school, and well, what do I want to do? What do I want to practice? Family medicine as a specialty really drew me in for those reasons, because family medicine was deeply involved in a lot of those movements. And then getting into residency, that was the first time that I really had the opportunity as a physician, as a healthcare provider, to provide care to trans folks, and was deeply impactful for me personally, very eye-opening. I think immediately saw the landscape that existed where you had a lot of trans folks who were struggling to get access to care, and many providers who did not have that education as a part of their core curriculum in medical schools, nursing schools, whatever the case may be. So you put those two together and there was a huge shortage in care, a big care gap. I immediately saw that, but I also saw that as I dug into it more and got more a part of that care and was building out a curriculum and a gender-affirming care protocol for the residency I was in, that it's not that hard to educate folks on this. And that when clinicians have that access to resources that they didn't get while they were in medical school and residency, they can provide this care quite easily. And it can be overnight life-saving. And putting all that together, I want this to be a part of my career, and ended up working in a federally qualified health center, which was full circle for me because, again, oh, I get to care for marginalized communities who are falling outside of the cracks of the healthcare system. It's a safety net setting. But even in that setting, while I was building out a gender-affirming care unit within that community health center and trying to get more people on board, building patients into my own practice, but I also wanted other providers to, of course, provide this care as well, people were still falling through the cracks. That was, I think, the ultimate light bulb moment. How else can this look? A lot of amazing work has been done. As I said, we often say we stand on the shoulders of giants for all of the amazing movements and work that's been done in the healthcare community for trans folks and other marginalized populations. But how can we think about this a little bit differently? So that was, I think, the spark moment. And then myself as a trans person, I came out on the job. I was working in a community health center with thousands of coworkers, thousands of patients. And even with a lot of information, knowledge, privilege into what this care involves, I still have my own challenges. And I certainly saw the patients facing a lot of barriers to care, again, even in that safety net setting. So that was my personal experience. My co-founder, also a physician, an ER physician, and had seen the pain points of healthcare on that side of things, and also had his own journey as a patient too, and had experienced a lot of pain when it came to recovery and figuring out financing of healthcare. And so I think we put all that together. We could create a care environment that is safe, or at least safer, that's affirming, that's high quality and accessible to the gender diverse and trans community, what would that look like? And so that's where we started from.
Jerrica, that's pretty impressive. As Xander said earlier, given the political changes, what are the challenges?
We think about that daily. And one side we look at it as we're facing a lot of what we've been facing. We started in 2019. That was when we first started our pilot, which eventually turned into Flume as we know it today. And we've, of course, been building that over the last 5 years. But that was during the first Trump administration. And even over the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen an onslaught of anti-trans legislation coming up on a state level. So before we even got to this current administration, the executive orders that we're seeing, the outlandish messaging and rules and proposed rules and everything at the federal level. But at the state level, we've been seeing this for a long time. So this is more of the same. We've been operating in this very complicated environment legislatively with a lot of pressures for a long time. You can, of course, rewind before 2019. We know that trans folks and many marginalized communities have been battling uphill when it comes to healthcare access and have faced a lot of discrimination and certainly legislative pressures when it comes to protection of our rights. But at the same time, we can look at it the other angle and say, well, yeah, this is newer. We're talking about broader scale implications when it comes to things we're seeing pulling out funding for organizations that take public funding who are providing care to trans folks, and not just on a state by state level, but doing that across the country. We've, of course, seen sweeping changes when it comes to our military personnel, our veterans. It is at a different level. And the one, not that this is new, but maybe it's just being amplified and happening on a higher scale, is the fear and the panic and the anxiety that comes from this. Because I think there's the actual real changes that occur, and whether it's our ability to access healthcare, change our legal documents, just exist as people in the world, face real threats of violence. But even outside of that, there's just a lot of confusion right now. And I think that's one of the intentions of this administration in particular, is to create that fear, confusion, panic state to ultimately try to undermine people in their daily lives.
One of the advantages that I think Plume Health has is that it's telemedicine. It's based on a virtual platform. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what are some of the advantages of being telehealth and having that virtual platform, and maybe how many states you're able to operate in? There's federal policy shifting that's happening, but there's been state things that have been going on for a while. And so you've been able to navigate some of that, I would imagine, quite successfully. So I'd love to hear if that has something to do with the fact that it's telemedicine or if it's these things are just coexisting.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We do operate fully virtually. We are entirely operating on a telemedicine platform. So that's how we deliver all of our care. Our clinical care, everything you'd see in your typical brick and mortar clinic, you meet with a doctor or a nurse practitioner, you get evaluated, you're providing a history, and then you get a medication for whatever condition that's being managed. You have ongoing longitudinal management, you have follow-up visits. It's all done virtually. But we also provide a lot of other things, social support, transition-related support that's not clinical in nature, a lot of peer support, which is how we provide a lot of mental and emotional support, connection to other people, webinars, educational events. So there's a whole bunch of things, but all of that is happening in this virtual platform. And you're right, Xander, that was a very intentional decision from the beginning. I've, of course, worked in a variety of brick and mortar settings up to that point. And one of the pieces of access was it was just really hard for people to get to a clinic, whether it was traveling geographic distances, uncomfortable moments in waiting rooms. There's only so much you can control. So if you can take all that out instantaneously with virtual access, it helps a lot. It's not a panacea by any means, but that was very intentional as part of that access piece. As you said, you start to intersect that with the regulatory and legislative landscape, and it can certainly be helpful in some ways, but it also can open up a whole box of hurdles when it comes to providing care across 48 states, as we're doing. We have taken care of over 40,000 patients to this point, have almost 17,000 active patients. And so when you're doing that across that broad range, you do have to be tracking a lot of things all the time. Of course, medical boards have their requirements for care, just for standards of care broadly. You have telemedicine standards. You have standards based on all the different licensing and regulatory bodies within healthcare. So there is a lot to track. And then on top of that, you throw on these anti-trans pieces of legislation, which are trying to undermine our care. And we've seen some very explicit examples of that in Florida with changes that happened with SB 254, to your point on this state legislation. And we've seen other attempts in many different states that fortunately have not gone through or have been overturned. So it is a constant process of having to monitor, understand how it impacts us. And this gets to our vision. which is the Transform Healthcare for Every Trans Life. Yes, we do that through these direct care modes that I've talked about, but we also want to learn from that care and share those learnings with other people. And so we've done that as well. And we've actually contributed to research and published papers. But then there's the advocacy side, right? And it's like, how can we leverage those learnings not only to improve our care, improve the care of the system broadly, but also to influence policy and make sure that those rights are really protected? Because we know that we're not going to care for every patient, right? That's not the intention. There's many different care environments. Everybody's got something that works for them, but we want to figure out how we can make an impact different ways. And so over the last 2 years, we have been more deeply involved on that legislative and advocacy front and trying to speak out against things that are, of course, restricting our rights, but also support the advocacy organizations who are trying to be proactive and put forth legislation which is protective in the first place.
Anna and I live in Florida. We're both trans. Let's use that as an example. You specifically mentioned here in Florida. Let's say somebody was interested in working with Plume, signing up, becoming a member. We should probably talk about your membership model as well. What are the regulations here in Florida specifically? How would somebody access Plume care in Florida that's different from another state, if you want to juxtapose that for people to understand how you're able to provide very specific care access based on the different states' policies and regulations and legislation?
So in Florida, there was a bill that was put forth a couple years ago now called SB 254, and that was ultimately signed into law. And that's set out a couple of restrictions. One of them was restricting the type of provider that can provide gender-affirming hormone therapy to trans people. And it said that nurse practitioners and PAs or physician assistants cannot do that. That's unprecedented. In fact, we know that nurse practitioners and physician assistants are a key part of the healthcare workforce at large, but also for the trans community. And of course, Florida knew that at the time. And so that's why they did that. And they said only physicians can provide this care. There's no basis for that whatsoever. But it did very quickly eat away at a healthcare workforce for that community and took away a lot of access. That was one thing they did. And they also said you had to have an in-person consent to even start or continue this care. When it comes to consent, informed consent is a practice of medicine that exists across all forms of medicine. I always like to remind folks of every doctor, nurse, et cetera, should be doing that with their patients all the time. It could be giving a joint injection, it could be prescribing a medicine for diabetes or high blood pressure. Anything should always involve a conversation about the risks and benefits and make sure that you have an informed decision as patients move through. Plenty of areas in healthcare where that doesn't happen as it should, but it's been hyper-focused on in trans care. And so what they said is you have to come in, fill out a form that actually the Board of Medicine in Florida put forward, which is deeply flawed. It's actually filled with misinformation, does not reflect the evidence base and the research that we have, and quite frankly, harmful just to be able to read that as a trans person and very discriminatory in and of itself. So that's what they required. And so, of course, if you are requiring an in-person consent, that takes away the ability to start people virtually. So we have had to adjust there. And what we've done is partner with local organizations so that we can have that in-person presence, make sure we get people consented. But one thing we really want to be sure about is acknowledging the misinformation that's in these board-approved consent forms. We do our own consent process, as we always do, to talk about the actual facts and the reality, the risk benefits that are there, and help folks make a decision. So that is one adjustment we've had to make, and only physicians can do that. So we have ourselves a team that's composed of physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. So we had to adjust there as well.
I've always been very critical of the informed consent. I'm so pleased to hear you talk about it in the way that you have. Because of this bill, can you talk about the challenges?
When I think about informed consent through my physician lens, it's a no-brainer. This is stuff that happens all the time now. And the care for trans folks, it has been interestingly, again, hyper-focused on, but also weaponized, especially historically, where there was not informed consent. You couldn't go to a doctor and talk to them and say, yeah, I understand all this, and this is what makes sense for me, and this is really going to help me, and we have a lot of data to show that it's life-saving. They couldn't do that. You had to see a therapist. You had to see a therapist, and sometimes for extended periods of time, upwards of a year, 2 years, and get a stamp to say, okay, you are trans and you can proceed with this care. And so that's what we've moved away from, especially in the last 10 years, to really reflect the reality of people and of all people. Like, nobody wants to have to get that stamp of approval just to be who we are. So when we talk about informed consent in the context of care for trans folks, that's really what we're talking about, is just like moving it to the standard that everybody has and experiences with their healthcare providers, and moving away from a gatekeeping model. Now, of course, we know that therapist emotional support modalities can be helpful for anybody, and they should be there and offered if people can utilize them as they need, but not as a necessarily requirement for everybody off out the gates. So Florida, they tried to reverse that. In fact, one thing that they had in the initial bill was a requirement to see a mental health practitioner, even to be able to have this care. That was actually taken out. But we've seen other states try to do that as well. Ohio was one, Missouri was one, who had a long list of requirements that would be necessary just to get something like hormone therapy that actually reflected the requirements of the past. So that's a little bit of background on informed consent, how it shows up, how it should show up in healthcare, and how it's been, again, like weaponized in some of these bills to try to limit access.
I remember originally the documentation, it required a psychiatric assessment. And I thought what they did was, instead of a psychiatric assessment, they still wanted people to at least get a baseline biopsychosocial assessment from perhaps a social worker. As a medical social worker, this has been one of my concerns, really, with some of the what's called informed consent treatment clinics, which I don't think most of them are. I think a lot of them are harm reduction. You're talking about an informed consent model. I think oftentimes individuals refer to other clinics as informed consent when they're really just harm reduction, like a drug and alcohol treatment program. And for me, the difference is that as a licensed clinical social worker who's worked in almost exclusively in medical settings, a comprehensive biopsychosocial assessment is not psychotherapy. And so, with the standards of care from WPATH, a World Professional Association for Transgender Health, for some of our listeners, the changes over times between standards of care version one to now eight, they've made a lot of changes and around psychotherapy. But I think the thing that gets skipped quite often, I had a conversation once with somebody who was a president of WPATH who didn't even know what a biopsychosocial assessment was, which I found quite troubling. But so I explained to them, it's maybe a 45 to 90 minute, depending on the age of the person or the issues going on, of just assessing, are you living in secure housing? Do you have a secure source of income? Do you have a social network and support system? Do you have health insurance or some kind of medical care? Asking about employment, sleep, medical issues, medications, all these different things, any comorbidities, dealing with mental illness. At the end of a biopsychosocial assessment, somebody may be referred to or recommended to do psychotherapy. And so when people started getting, say, within the trans community, more advocacy-oriented or activist-oriented members of the community would say, no more gatekeeping. That was the language. We don't need to be affirmed by, we know who we are. Yeah, of course. But what ended up happening, in my opinion, is because most people don't know about a biopsychosocial assessment done by a social worker, and sometimes others, sometimes nurses do them as well, the most comprehensive ones. I think doctors do them, people do them, but that really comprehensive one about, okay, you're going to be starting a medicine. It's new for you. It's going to have an impact on your life. Are you connected to a community? So now you've got your social and emotional support services. So that's great. But a lot of the clinics don't, and they haven't. They just go in, get their medicine, go out, and they're expected to just sort of figure it out on their own. And so this biopsychosocial assessment piece, I think, has been overlooked or missed or not known about. And so people aren't at least being assessed to make sure that they have all the things that they need. And if they don't, they get the referrals, the recommendations, the warm handoffs, the resources, and that's it. No, you have a mental illness and you need therapy. Do you see the value in biopsychosocial assessment? Because a lot of the places, they don't have social workers. And so I'm just wondering, one, does Plume offer biopsychosocial assessment? And just what are your thoughts in general about the maybe the no gatekeeping movement? We might have skipped over something that I think might be a necessity. And maybe that's just my occupational bias, but I've worked with trans people for so many years, and there's so much that we glean from that assessment that I feel is really helpful for people to continue on down their path with all the things that they need, resources and people.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Jerrica Kirkley. Dr. Jerrica Kirkley, with another partner, started Plume Health. Plume Health has transformed the care landscape for the trans community despite the adversarial political climate. Want to thank our sponsors once again. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is Dr. Jerrica Kirkley. Let's get back to where we left off.
Yeah. When I hear the word biopsychosocial assessment, what I think about is holistic care. And I always love to pull back from the trans community. And when you get deep into this work, it's so easy to get focused on, well, what's the best thing for the trans community? And that's great. We want a lot of energy going into what's the best thing for the trans community. But it is, I do think, a very slippery slope into gatekeeping. And it's the reason I bring the notion of pulling back from the trans community is like, let's just look at healthcare for everybody. So psychosocial assessment is an amazing tool for everybody and should be used. And I think when I look at, as a primary care provider, a family physician, I have taken care of so many people with so many different conditions. In primary care world, so much of what you're seeing is poorly controlled diabetes, poorly controlled hypertension, poorly controlled heart disease. And you can see these people till they're blue in the face. You can have 100 visits a year. You can have a social worker, a mental health worker, everything. And it's still really hard. And the reality, to your point, Xander, is that most clinics don't have those resources. These primary care clinics doing the hard work, heart disease is still the number one killer of people in this country. Most clinics are not doing legit biopsychosocial assessments, but they should be. So I think when we look at the healthcare system, what is ideal? Certainly holistic assessment and referral and care navigation is the gold standard, but there's so many pieces of our healthcare system that don't have that. When I look at trans care specifically, and I can easily say, yes, that's great to have. It's in fact what we're trying to build at Plume, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But if I look at it side by side with the rest of the healthcare world and see what are the trade-offs, because if you don't have that in PCPs, primary care providers treating diabetes, people die. Even in best case, you work as hard as you can, it's really hard to get an A1C down. There's a lot of ramifications that can come from that with diabetes care just specifically. But in trans care, if you have that gold standard, that's amazing. You're going to see outcomes get better. But even just being able to provide that care, and this is something that I've seen personally, it's in the evidence. There's a lot of publications around this. Just being able to provide that care, something like hormone therapy, that for a long time was inaccessible and could be deeply affirming and can overnight change the health of an individual in a way that I've actually never seen and very rarely seen with anything else in healthcare. So just that one piece alone can put a person on a path to being able to do all those other things and go back and get a degree, feel more confident being out in the world exercising, which of course improves health outcomes, being able to get that job, whatever it is. So, I mean, we get comments all the time from patients who just were able to plug into care, get that basic care, and their lives are dramatically changed. Now, on top of that, if you can do that full assessment and concretely link people to resources, then you're doing even better. So I think it's always just like degrees of good. But there's also, I think it is important to acknowledge the health system broadly and how that shows up in different spaces. But getting to Plume, fully agree. And a lot of that you can bake into the initial assessment. And so even with when we started, we didn't have a team of social workers. But what we did do is really intentional about asking a lot of those questions up front. And to the best we can, build those referral networks and go into local communities and get people connected to resources. Now, over time, we do have things like our peer support groups, where it is more formal support and a lot of formal resource provision. The next chapter is moving into more formal care navigation. So to build on that initial assessment that we're already doing, that's reviewed by the clinicians and the care team and the care coordinators, to really proactively getting a level deeper to your point of, yeah, what's your income level? What's checking on disability status, veteran status, whatever the case may be, all these different things that make us who we are that impact our health. And that gets into the social determinants of health conversation. And then doing really pointed resource navigation, whether within Plume or outside of Plume, to make sure that not just the clinical needs are attended to, but all those things are. So yeah, I 100% agree. It's a big yes, and we got to make sure sure we're doing that for everybody. And if there's areas where we're not in healthcare, then let's make sure we're doubling down there as well.
The only time I've actually seen biopsychosocial built in is in home health and hospice. In those services, I've seen that. I've been part of those organizations. But outside of home health and hospice, I've not seen that.
Yeah.
See, that's terrible. I mean, as a social worker previously employed by the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense, that was almost all that I did. It was just day after day, hour after hour, biopsychosocial. And that was regardless of whether I was working with people that were being referred over for dialysis or organ transplant or to the caregiver program or to who were members of the healthcare for homeless program that I worked for and were seeking temporary, transitional, permanent housing. It was foundational. Or when I was on a med surge unit, we did biopsychosocial to prepare for discharge planning. Mm-hmm. Or when I was an inpatient psychiatric, we did it just to help with also not just the care, but the discharge. As a medical social worker, a lot is on that. So when people say to me, well, why should we have to do that? Nobody else is. Yeah, they are. But now what I'm hearing from both of you is that I've actually worked in places where that's just par for the course.
Yeah,
it's just what we do as social workers in federal government healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm bummed out about it a little bit now to hear that it's so underavailable or underappreciated, or in my example that I gave previously, just unknown, right? Unknown.
I think also, Xander, because I talk about this very issue when I teach hormones, I can understand why people are so resistant to have to talk to a therapist, because they are fearful that they're going to talk to people who don't understand the trans person in the first place, let alone have the skill sets on how to have those conversations. And the provider is doing the best that they can, but it's from a medical perspective. And the way you would do it, Jerrica or Xander, or the way I would do it, isn't going to be quite the same. For many of these providers, it's a process. It's having to meet standards and getting the person moved into care. There's a huge gap there. And for many people, it does feel like gatekeeping. They don't feel well understood. You're questioning who I am. I know who I am. I think that's what's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think because what we're highlighting is there's two truths. One, like, yes, there has been a lot of gatekeeping and there's been a lot of harm that's been done by the healthcare system. And so part of this is unpacking all that and how do we do this and not cause harm, right? And the trans community is not the only one. Of course, there's many communities who have not fit into that one size fits all healthcare system based on race and ethnicity, based on many different gender identities. And so it has caused harm. And so let's acknowledge that as a truth. And then number two, there are models that, as you both pointed out, can be really great and work quite well. But then the question is, how do we implement that? And so it brings a couple of things to mind. One is that virtual model. So I'd love to talk about that a little bit in the context of that biopsychosocial model and really attending to the whole person and also the care model that we have. And so one of the things that we've built and we're super intentional about from the beginning is having care delivered by people with the lived experience of those you're serving. And so for us, that means over half the organization is trans and gender diverse. There's a lot of intersectionality within that. And of course, many other strong advocates, allies, and people in the queer community. And so that does make us a little bit unique, but that's one of the things I think is so important is, so even when we're thinking about, well, what does an onboard process look like? What are those questions to ask? How do you do it, to your point, in a way that feels relatable? I mean, that's one of our mission statement is to provide relatable and reliable care. And we do that by connecting to the lived experience of people. So that's, I think that's one thing that's just been really hard to do in healthcare, but I think is important and can start to break down a lot of this, the harm that can be created, right? We're really building care systems from within based on lived experience. And then getting to the, you know, the virtual aspect, it's doing that full biopsychosocial model. While it's a gold standard, can be really hard because of cost limitations, hiring workforce in your maybe typical primary care clinic or federally qualified health center, which are strapped for funding all the time, to really do that fully. And so our trick is, okay, how can we build that in a virtual environment and make it feel really seamless, but also really comprehensive? And so something that we've really been delving into lately is this notion of virtual care pathways. And so to your point is, like, when you come in, there should be a full assessment that's done. It could be done with a person, can be done in a form, combination thereof, but it goes into a actual database. And based on what's entered into that, ideally, you're just automatically moved into these different things. It could be, oh, hormone therapy is a part of it, or you're connected to a peer support group, or You're connected to a care navigator, a social worker to find a resource for finding a job. And I think that's okay, let's take these systems that have worked really well in home health and brick and mortar settings and replicate that and almost automate it to a certain point that helps people move through it easier and also efficiently and at scale, because we'd love to hire 100 social workers that might not be accessible to us in many clinics. And so if we can't do that, how do we take the real awesome work that's been done and apply it in that environment and still have, of course, the personal touch around it and that lived experience around it?
I think that would be very doable. I've worked in clinics where people are answering things, EHQ-9, GAD-7, these assessments for anxiety, depression, and then the clinician gets the score. When you see the score, you could say, oh, as a social worker, this person might need a referral to one of our support groups, or they might need a referral to the suicide prevention team, or they might need a referral to psychotherapy or something out in the community based on how they answer those questions. And oftentimes, even when I just go see just my primary care doc, I have to do those now. They're doing those just as part of primary care around anxiety and depression. And so I really appreciate that. Plume Health is a member model. What does that mean? What are the options available for people who believe or think it's unaffordable for them?
Right. So when we say membership, that speaks to all the different types of care that we're providing. And we started from the very beginning with a monthly membership fee. So the idea is, as opposed to on a paying per visit basis, you pay a one transparent monthly fee. Of course, we see membership models with a lot of different things. So that notion, but it covers everything. No matter if you need 5 visits that month or no visits that month, or you're getting labs done, or maybe you're not getting labs done, or you have a bunch of messages you're sending to the care team through the portal. Again, we've created a one-size-fits-all model with healthcare, certainly based on identities, backgrounds, conditions, but we've also done that in the way we expect people to show up. Come to the clinic once a quarter, get your blood work, see the doctor, and then you go home. It just doesn't always make sense because your needs are going to fluctuate in that time. So it's moving more towards this value-based care approach on a static fee. And we're going to provide as much care as we need to make sure that you get what you need and that that care is high quality. So it's not driving a set number of visits or whatever it is. So the tail's not wagging the dog, basically. We know that so much of that has happened from health insurance. So that was the dream. And we had to set a price point that, of course, covered the cost of care. Cost of healthcare is rising exponentially and has been for quite some time. The cost of healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, et cetera, the technology to do it, the electronic medical records, the inflation on that is ridiculous. And so you got to find something that it allows you to operate the healthcare model. That's where we started from. But 2 years ago, we started accepting health insurance. To your point, Xander, was, hey, this is a price point that's accessible for many, but there's probably many people that aren't be able to access that. And you could even look at it side by side. Well, $1,200 a year for healthcare, covering a lot of your needs, but maybe not all of them, make a lot of sense for some people who might be going and paying, and I've seen this, even in federally qualified community health centers, $700 to $900 a visit. Right? We're talking $1,200 a year, $700 to $900 a visit for just a one visit with a doctor and labs. So side by side, it can oftentimes come out less expensive, but that's not the case for everybody. So health insurance helps with that because, of course, you still have a copay, you have your monthly premium that you're paying with health insurance, but ideally that is reimbursing most of the cost associated with labs and visits. That's one way we've helped reduce that cost. There's still a little bit of a membership fee to cover all that, what we were talking about in that biopsychosocial model, like the community and wellness benefits that we have packed into that membership. And that's also what makes it a membership. It's not just clinical care. It's not just going to a doctor or a nurse and a virtual visit, it's all those things, peer support groups, social and legal navigation, connecting with other patients in our community hub and attending educational events. And we're building on that with the care navigation piece more formally. And then beyond that, we have had a partnership with Point of Pride from the beginning, which is a really cool organization started by Aiden Dowling, one of the first trans YouTubers, as we say, which now, of course, is, I don't know, maybe an obsolete term. It's all Instagram and TikTok. But that was where it all started. And he's super cool and started this organization called Point of Pride, which provides scholarships money, but started out to support gender-affirming surgery. And we worked with them in the early days to start a gender-affirming hormone therapy fund. And now they've expanded it and have created all sorts of cool programs supporting things like electrolysis or other needs relating to care for trans folks, and have partnerships now with multiple clinical organizations and care organizations. That's something that's available where people can apply. It's needs-based, similar to a sliding scale model where you fill out an application, and of course, we try to get folks the care that they need, might not be able to afford it, and always exploring other opportunities. But, and a lot of the work that we do on a daily basis, which is hard grinding work, is talking to health insurance companies, trying to get our reimbursement rates up. That's a continual challenge for all care, from medical care to mental health care. And also trying to find ways to really more meaningfully move into that value-based world where health insurance companies are actually compensating us on that more per member per month or per member per year basis. Because with health insurance at this moment, it's all fee for service. We have this hybrid model where, yes, we have a membership aspect, but when we're using health insurance, we still have to have a visit to get paid by health insurance companies. We can't just provide good care and get paid. That would be ideal. We're still trying to figure that piece out, but those are a few of the things that we've done to help with the cost burden.
It sounds like case management.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. I mean, a lot of what Xander was talking about at the beginning is it really is case management. I agree. Yeah, that's the traditional term, but it's just applying it in this context. Yeah.
Are you working with underwriters at insurance companies?
We are. Yeah, we have what we call fee-for-service contracts with a fair number of payers right now. We're providing care in 48 states. Within that, we have health insurance contracts in about 30 of those states. A number of contracts per state. You just have to go one at a time. You Blue Cross Blue Shield contract, you get your Aetna contract, get your Cigna. So that's just basic billing. But we are trying to talk to those health insurance companies to create something, as you said, that's more bespoke, that's more on that case management side of paying for healthcare and paying for all of it. Because the reality right now is all those things, then that biopsychosocial model, community and wellness services we do, we're not even reimbursing for this right now. And that's where that membership fee falls in, and it is falling on the burden of the individual. And so we'd love to be like, hey, how can we be creative here? Work with health insurance companies, whether they're not just covering the prescription care, the clinician care, the clinical stuff, but also that community and wellness care.
Back in the years when I was working in hospice programs, we sometimes would have to place phone calls on behalf of patients and families to the insurance company and inquire into whether or not they had case management. And there almost seems to be a competitive edge. So you have to compose the question and then hope that they connect you to case management. The patient or family member wouldn't often know if their insurance provider offered case management. People very rarely go through the documents and the fine print. It's mundane to them and it's overwhelming. I think sometimes with these insurance companies, it's getting them to understand the benefits and the cost savings.
Exactly.
We are going to take our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Jerrica Kirkley, who is discussing how Plume Health has transformed the care landscape for the trans community despite the adversarial political climate. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. We are interviewing Dr. Jerrica Kirkley, who is discussing how Plume Health has transformed the landscape for the trans community. Plume Health offers telehealth care and services to the trans community across 48 states. Let's pick up where we left off.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, it's a great point, and there's so many ways we can take that. Because right now we're talking about more internally assessing the broad array of needs, connecting to outside resources. And yes, I agree, that is cost savings. Because if people aren't being assessed, aren't being connected to resources, what is it going to result in? High misutilization of healthcare, winding up in emergency rooms. And that's what happens to so many people for many different reasons, but in the trans community as well. How do we actually look at data, understand what is our ER utilization of our patients? What do hospitalization rates look like? And when we're doing this, how do we see those change? And I'll say there's a lot of companies who are trying to crack that. That's a hard one. But there's even companies which are being created, digital health startups entirely dedicated to social determinants of health, tracking, and understanding when you do connect to resources, are we seeing a meaningful change in high-cost hospitalizations and ER visits?
Yeah. No, I'm glad that you brought that up on because I'm a social worker, but my job titles were almost always something like clinical case manager, because that's the kind of work I was doing. There's a couple of other ways that I think about making access to trans healthcare. Plume Health in particular would be oftentimes people who are employed, their employers offer them those, I always forget what they're called, but it's like a special credit card that you could put funds on pre-tax, and then you can use that to pay for your prescriptions. And so I'm wondering if people are using those to pay for that monthly fee. And then also going the employee benefit plan route. I have worked for a number of years now for some mental health employee benefit companies. So the company itself buys the plan, and then the employee has access to it for free. And it includes mental health and a lot of times coaching, mental health coaching, and also mental health medication prescription options. And I remember Included Health used to do an employee benefit plan for their LGBT healthcare concierge service. So I'm wondering, is that something that you're doing or you're looking at doing, the getting the employer to pay for everything?
It's a really great question. On the first set one, patients can use like an FSA, I think is what you're referring to, like a benefits card to pay for Plume, and we can provide an invoice back to the patient if they need to submit to their insurance company or their employer for FSA usage. So that can be done. Getting contracts with employers is a strategy out there that we've seen, to your point, in a lot of digital health companies, especially on the mental health side and in other areas. It gets a little tricky for us because with just the way the trans community is distributed, we know there's at least a couple million trans folks in this country, probably more. But when you distribute that across 50 states and a whole bunch of employers, then it starts to dwindle the size of the community per employer, unless you're just a very massive jumbo employer. Those are, as you can imagine, probably really hard to get into and are very selective of their benefits. And there's a lot of things to consider. But if you take that, it does become a little challenging, because if you'd have to, a mental health benefit, you can find a couple of employers that cover a lot of people. And you know right off the bat, there's a lot of people that can use that. But if it's a trans-specific benefit, then of course that's only going to be utilized by those who are trans or gender diverse in that company. And on a per company basis, that number is pretty low. So then what we'd have to do is build out a bunch of different, of course, contracts with employers. And those can be tricky. Those are costly in and of themselves. It's great that employers want to support trans people, but there's a lot of red tape attached to it and what those relationships have to look like and who's managing them. And so our goal is to try to go direct to payer. And we know that many, of course, commercial payers are the ones providing the benefits ultimately for many companies. So that's the goal, is to try to cover as many people as possible, keep that net really wide. And the goal would be that regardless of what company you work for, if we're in network for that payer, you should be able to use it with Plume. But doing it on a per employer basis is a little tricky.
You know, I appreciate that. I guess I didn't even think about the numbers. Plume Health is for adult, correct? Is it 18 and up in all of the 48 states?
That's right. Yeah, 18 plus. And there are some exceptions to that. Again, this gets to some of the anti-trans pieces of legislation we've seen, but in some states, they've changed the age of a minor to starting at 19. And we've actually seen a lot of bills this legislative session in states like Texas and others who are trying to even push that age of a minor even higher, up to 21, 26 in some cases, and all in an effort to restrict care. So there's a couple of exceptions there on the 19 being the entry point, but for most states, it's 18 plus. Yeah.
Well, Jerrica, this has been a really wonderful conversation. I've learned a lot. We've got a couple minutes left. I'm wondering, what didn't we talk about that you'd like to mention? And I also want you to be able to tell us, how does somebody find Plume?
First one's easy. You can just go to getplume.co. So getplume.co. That's our website. And we'll have a lot of information there. You can click a link that says get started and learn about all the services that we provide. As far as the first part of the question, I think we did cover a lot, and it has been a really wonderful conversation. One thing that we didn't state explicitly is, what are our long-term goals? It really gets back to that vision statement of transforming healthcare for every trans life. But one of the pieces of that is, in addition to expanding the services as we've talked about and really trying to provide that holistic model of care, is looking at health outcomes. And that becomes a connector to a lot of the things that we have talked about. It helps even in those negotiations with health insurance companies and showing that, hey, the care we provide does improve outcomes and it ideally lowers cost. One of the goals we have is that the health outcomes of our community that we're taking care of are equal to or better than the general population. And I think we can do, of course, a whole lot better than the general population, but we have to acknowledge we're starting on our heels because of a lot of the discrimination and bias bias in healthcare, we know that trans folks, in addition to many marginalized communities, are disproportionately affected by things like mental health, substance use, violence, STI, HIV. We really want to move the needle on that in a meaningful way. And we think the way to do that is exactly what we've talked about, that holistic model of care that is acknowledging both the clinical needs and those community and wellness and full biopsychosocial model approach. So that's the one thing I just wanted to highlight is we really want to be meaningfully looking at these health outcomes and measuring them over time. And so hopefully we'll prove out that when you provide people good care, that they get healthier. And so I think that's what we want to show.
Well, thank you, Jerrica, for coming on the show. It's been a really wonderful opportunity to learn more about Plume Health and just to have a nice conversation.
Oh, no, I really enjoyed this. Thank you both. Yeah, it's been a very thought-provoking. And I love the connections we made where there are these models of care that have existed for a long time. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is incorporate those. Yeah. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you so much, Jerrica.
Thank you, Jerrica. Plume Health is pleased to sponsor this episode of the Umbrella Hour podcast. Plume Health is the largest virtual provider of healthcare, including gender-affirming care and transition support services for trans and gender-diverse adults in the United States. To learn more about Plume Health, their full range of services, insurance plans they accept, and states they operate in, visit getplume.co. That's getplume.co. Thank you for listening.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You were listening to our guest, Dr. Jerrica Kirkley, discussing how Plume Health has transformed the care landscape for the trans community, despite the adversarial political climate. Thank you again for joining us this hour. Until next time.